Welcome to the 82nd-ish episode of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck? Where we revisit great movies from the 80s and 90s that actually might suck. How's it going?
Hey, I'm Travis Centel.
I'm Kalen Eakin.
Man, it's good to spend a Sunday doing this.
Yeah, this is going to be a good 4.5-5 hours.
We're going to go back to the movies.
Back to the past and back to the future, too.
Can't wait.
And to the distant future.
Yep. I am.
For the first time. First time to the future. Part one.
I'm legitimately excited about this. I will say I was coming over here today and thinking, there's nothing I want more. Nothing's a strong word. I'm excited to go watch Back to the Future 2.
And I am too.
I was not that excited necessarily when we pulled it, but it is the exact way I want to spend my afternoon. God's honest truth. It really is.
It's funny because we've been really, really living in this Kennedy Marshall Spielberg world for the last number of episodes, except for Purple Rain. But this is the team that brought us Back to the Future 1. Of course, it is. Which we loved. Which I actually re-listened to part of that episode in preparation for this episode.
I didn't do that homework.
I just didn't want to repeat ourselves.
When you said we're living in this Kennedy. I thought you were going to talk about the Supreme Court for a second, because that's the world I've been living in. And one of the reasons I'm excited to go to a future that's dystopian is that this week has been very hard politically.
That's right.
And I thought you were going a different direction.
We made a deal with ourselves not to talk about political parallels because it's too stupid a conversation.
No, that was the first thing I said when we, after off air, I was like, please, can we not make any Trump Biff references? Yeah. So we're just now committing to you guys.
That's the last you've heard of that. We're not going to talk about it because it's too dumb.
We heard it. We know it.
Yeah.
But we should.
Well, speaking of Spielberg, we have something that we need to discuss.
We need to admit. I'll let you lead it. Okay. So here's what happened, you guys. We recorded an episode last week, and my friend Mike Garner, regular listeners will know his name, was in town on his way to China, where he is performing on Cirque du Soleil. And I asked him what movie he'd like to do, and he said The Goonies. And I thought, well, this is prime territory. This is not our normal thing. I always ask guests when they're coming on, what do you think it's going to be, or what do you want to do? Just to see what they say. And it doesn't usually impact our decision, with the exception of my sister, who, you know, wanted to watch True Romance, whatever.
Well, there was a little more to
it. Yeah,
but
whatever. Let's not relitigate.
Travis is trying to justify letting somebody else break our rules.
Yeah. I am. I am justifying it. And
unjustifiable.
So Mike Garner was in town. He came over, and the movie that he wanted to do is the movie that's been looming large over the podcast, which is a movie that Kalen knows is bad. And
I thought I knew that.
And I was scared that was bad, and I'd avoided it. And that movie is The Goonies. And I thought, it's good to bring this up at least as an option. Instead of Back to the Future 2, what if we did one of the massive shows that's been looming over our heads, and a movie I had avoided watching for 20 years because I was afraid it was not good, but desperately hoped it was good. Anyway, long story short, we recorded the podcast.
Well, wait a minute. Let's make this long story long
a
little bit.
Sure.
So Travis says to me, hey, I have a guest coming up who I want to bring on, which I had no problem with, even though we sort of pretend that there's a fight going on between me and Mike. Of course there was not, and he's a very nice guy. And so I thought that was great. Let's have Mike on. And then Travis said, and I think that we should let him pick the movie, or we should do a movie that he wants to do that's really important to him. And I had huge problems.
Huge.
With this.
Guys, bigger than you think problems.
Way bigger than you think. And I know that seems crazy considering how we sometimes bend or shatter the rules.
Wait, because I don't think we do. I think you do.
I do. Yeah, sure. That's fair. I do. I like to do it sometimes, especially when I am trying to make the best possible show.
Or assuage an itch in your gut.
Yes. If something just strikes me as wrong. And I mean, like, look, I try to be pretty honest about this. But like, let's say, for instance, the last time I did it was, and this is being more candid than perhaps we have been about certain things in the past. The last time I did it was because I felt like this was on the Meaning of Life episode. And I was like throwing out Heathers and throwing out RoboCop, Karate Kid, all these movies that I know were sort of right in the wheelhouse of what this show is supposed to be. But I had felt at that time like we'd done too many of those in a row of that kind of, you know, I don't know what you call that, but that particular brand of sort of cult nostalgia. And I felt like we'd done kind of a bust of an episode on Meaning of Life. Yeah. I didn't really like it. I thought it was boring. I thought it was sort of, we didn't really get to anything interesting. It was perhaps another case of our bag being too large, although I think it was worth talking about Monty Python. And so I sort of pushed it until I got to something that I thought would be a good episode, and I thought that Purple Rain was a pretty awesome episode. So all to sort of post-justify when we sort of challenge things, that I feel like I have a reason. What I was uncomfortable with was somebody coming in, and the thing that I have tried very hard not to do on this show is direct it to somebody saying, I loved this movie and I want to go back. And that feels too specific.
Which I agree with. And also, that is a bit of a mean concept. And I think that that is something.
Exactly.
I get it. No, I get it.
We already have this title and that already I feel sort of uncomfortable.
And I don't think our ethos or our objective is to say, oh, that's your favorite movie? You fucking dummy.
Yeah.
That is not what we're doing here and not what we're interested in. I understand that pushback. However, in this case, I thought we have a fake beef going on. What an opportunity. Because when Kalen says he knows a movie's bad, he's usually right. Let's just, we all know that. And let's just fucking say it on air so everyone hears it. Whatever, fuck you. It's true. So I thought, well, this is a funny structure for an episode. If the fake beef comes on and says, this is my favorite movie, and then sees it, realizes it's not, and Kalen gets to trash it, that's fun. That structurally, I was like, that can work. That's going to be a funny idea to do. Let's posit it on air. And so we posit it on air. Kalen sort of goes, well, sure, we can do that, whatever. Yeah. He sort of goes.
I decided I would be generous and I would and I would just try the experiment because like what it's not that big a deal.
Yeah, and structurally it made sense. It's the one time I think that structure would feel, if it felt mean, that meanness would be part of the shtick. And
it could be
funny.
Fun.
That was my whole idea, which I stand by that idea.
It's a fine idea. It is a fine idea.
Is good. Anyway, so we recorded it, and look, all three of us didn't have a good time is the best way of saying it. Mike was jet lagged. I was tired. Kalen actually started in a pretty good place, if I'm being honest, and then got dour, I think, in the midpoint.
Yeah.
Like, you came out with a bit and some shtick that was pretty funny and, like, is good, and then it just kind of everything got – once we watched the movie, shit took a turn.
There was a moment – and, again, this was part of the creeping sensation of, like, I don't think this is going to work. And I didn't anticipate that so bad, but there was a moment where we paused the Goonies. Everyone's sitting there stone silent. Watching the Goonies. Imagine that, first of all. And Mike Garner, our guest, had to go to the bathroom, and he left. And it was just Travis and I in the room. And I looked at Travis, and I was like, this is maybe the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. And so, and that was not a joyful comment. That was, I am in hell. And so even then, I was like, well, we can do this.
We can
have a good conversation about this. This is obviously striking deep to the heart of what we're talking about. But it wasn't fun, and I didn't think it was a good conversation. And it wound up feeling, to me, too cynical or cruel or something. It just didn't have any
joy. It was
an
hour and 50 minutes.
It was hella long.
I would, Kalen will dispute this, I would say 20 minutes of that, 15 to 20 minutes of that, I think we've stumbled on some really clever, intelligent thoughts about childhood films, about nostalgia, about the things our podcast traffics in, that I was pleased with. I think we realized some things about the film that were smart, that I had not thought about, and part of that was very good. We wrestled with posting that episode if the other hour and 30 was kind of a slog for something that should be a heavy hitter that people might go to if they're visiting the podcast for the first time. We really wrestled with it. The opposing, and we won't spend much more time on this because you don't care, but the opposing,
you'll note that it's not posted.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is what we're sort of explaining, that we recorded an entire episode that for the moment we're going to just sort of hang on to.
And we have it, and maybe at some point we'll change our mind. We haven't listened back to it, so we don't know if this is true, but it didn't feel good to all three of us, I feel like. So of course Mike Garner's invited back. Of course the fake beef will continue on. Of course it's not real. But it didn't feel joyful, and it didn't feel exploratory or revelatory. We didn't come to conclusions the way we have in previous episodes. And we thought, this is not necessarily the place, the foot we want to put forward. My argument is that it is real and it happened and we should post it, because that's, what else are we doing besides just two dudes being real, guys?
Yeah, and my argument is, why waste somebody's hour and 50 minutes for something we know is bad?
Yeah.
So
we'll listen back to it at some point, and maybe at some point we'll post it.
And please, maybe this thing is off of it by not making it part of the show. And maybe, who knows? Like, maybe someday, a few down the line, if people want to hear it, I guess, we could put it up
Yeah, let us know if you want to hear it, and if we get enough traffic on it, we'll put it up.
But know that it's not. It's just like, to me, it was like, this doesn't, this both counters and what's the word I want to say? Like, you said it well, which is like the ethos of the show. It just doesn't feel like something that we felt contributed, I don't know, to anybody's good time, like, you know.
Yeah, and maybe what we do, whatever, we can all sideline the rest of that. I have some ideas about how to talk about the Goonies, which I do think is indicative and important to our podcast. I do have things I stumbled on that I'm proud of thinking about or coming to conclusions I came to. I think Kaylin had some good points, you know, that I think that we sort of worked somewhere that is important for the two of us, at least, to talk about Goonies. We'll spend no more time on it today, I think, unless there's any closing thoughts you have.
No, none.
Okay, so that's that. Back to the Future 2.
Back to the Future 2. So this is funny. This is the first time we've done, like, I was trying to think about it. I know that our show hasn't been on this long, but it's I certainly haven't watched Back to the Future 2 since we watched Back to the Future 1.
Oh, for sure.
And it's been like at least a year, I guess. And so it has been a big gap to where it might feel a little bit like how people first saw Back to the Future 2.
Yeah, that's fair. Okay. Yeah,
like, there was this incredible movie, and we had this, even though we both knew, this is what struck me listening back to the Back to the Future episode, which I would encourage people to do. I think it's a good episode, is we were expecting it to be good, because of course it's Back to the Future.
Yeah.
But we were both sort of bowled over by how good, and that was really fun to listen to and remember. And then as we sort of, so it had the surprise effect that I think it had to people when it first came out. Why is Back to the Future a great, great movie? Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's a crazy thing, that Back to the Future, this little movie about
a teenager
who goes to the 50s to reunite his parents or whatever, is an incredible piece of cinematic, like, art and accomplishment. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
As one of the best pop movies ever made. And so, of course, you get Back to the Future 2, but you weren't supposed to get it. Like that movie is perfect as it is. There's no the fake sequel promise is not real. It's just a total lark gag. It's just one more of a million incredible gags. And yet here they were facing a success, and what do you do? This is like an early example of the original filmmakers deciding to sequelize their perfect thing. Like, Spielberg begs off Jaws 2. You know, he'd never made E.T. 2. Like, all these movies that were sort of around this same era, that it was sort of traditionally thought of as, you know, weak to take on your own sequel.
Was Indiana Jones in that camp?
Well, Indiana Jones is, I guess, the first. You're right. It's probably the first example of him of somebody really doing that.
Yeah, but that is built into the ethos of that. Is a serialized sort of pulpy mentality.
But funny enough, it was not his idea. Spielberg wanted, I believe, to create a character that other people would take on. And it just wound up being something that he loved so much, that he felt such ownership over, that they all, that sort of trio, decided to keep going.
Yeah. And no one begrudges them that, I think.
No, of course not.
Except for Crystal Skull.
But interestingly, you know, it's funny you mention that, because so Indiana Jones Temple of Doom is 84.
Mm-hmm.
And people often accuse it of being cruel and mean and dark.
Yes.
And Back to the Future, and it was what, 3 years after Raiders, and Back to the Future 2 is, you know, three or four years after Back to the Future 1, and people also accuse it of being mean and cruel and dark.
Yeah, I am interested in that, and we should talk a little bit about that. I think the natural entry point into that is probably Crispin Glover as a good starting point.
Oh, sure.
I'm sure I told the story about my friend trying to rent a room from Crispin Glover.
You did.
Crispin Glover, yeah. And so when that happened, I went to a Crispin Glover deep dive a little bit. And famously, you guys probably all know this, but he demanded the same amount of money for Back to the Future 2 as Michael J. Fox was getting. His agents told him this. This actually, on a sidebar, actually started a fairly aggressive Hollywood battle that lingers to this day in terms of lots of just the way agents negotiate and the way people think about sequel rights and actors' fees.
Right.
Sidebar, interesting, look it up, Google it. What happened was, this became very acrimonious, and for a while, Crispin Glover wasn't going to do it, and then it looked like he was going to do it, and so the screenwriters...
Well, we talked about this on the first one, too, and one of the things that you said, which was interesting, is that they had not... They just knew they wanted to make Back to the Future 2. They didn't have a script, they didn't have a plot, and so they would have or could have bent it to make George McFly some major part of the narrative.
Yep.
And they weren't obligated to do that, or they weren't obligated not to do that. And so this rights negotiation was in advance of that, that creative decision.
So, yeah, what they did was, meanly, and this is why I'm bringing it in this way, they wrote in a very bit part for him where he was upside down, hanging upside down in a sort of painful way of shooting for almost all of his shots, if not all of his shots. And then the contract negotiations fell apart, and then they end up having a George McFly lookalike guy hanging upside down. The reason he's hanging upside down in the shots that he's in is because it was supposed to be a fuck you to Crispin Glover, basically. So it's coming weird. From a dark...
Yeah,
place,
so strange.
Even in a construction phase. So it does seem like the movie is tainted by a bit of like a bad place to begin the narrative.
That and that it's just, it's crassly commercial no matter what. I mean, it's funny because Zemeckis didn't write it. You know, Bob Gale wrote this by himself. He wrote the next, you know, two and three together.
And Bob Gale not as good of a writer.
Yeah, well, and also, you know, one of the things that we said on the first the about the first film is that it's known to be a heavy rewrite process on that film, like draft after draft after draft that became Back to the Future. And I only can assume that you have one writer, you're going for a director's scheduled date, you're trying to get to production, you know you have kind of a surefire hit, you're going to do two back to back, in fact, is how you've crunched the numbers or crunched the box office here. In order to make it a bigger event. And it's already, you're coming at it from such a far more cynical, greed-oriented place, which is exactly the stigma of sequels, you know, from that time. So it feels like they're very openly playing into this.
Unpacking and using plot details from her first film in a service of building a new plot is something that I've become really frustrated by. Point to Solo, for example. Point to some of the Star Wars backstory stuff. You know, things that work as casual mentions in a first go-round servicing a different plot don't often, if ever, bear up to unpacking them as plot points for future films, in my experience.
Right.
So there is some of that in this movie that's very frustrating. I do recall some cool...
Here's what I was going to say is, all of that said, you know, and I can't remember. I mean, this has been a problem for me my entire life, you know, is I don't remember if Back to the Future 2 is good or bad.
Yeah.
I don't remember. And, you know, we were talking about this, like, I even on this show, when we do an episode, and this is maybe the pervasive nature of nostalgia. I think we actually talked about this a little bit on the Goonies episode. I can't remember what I thought of a movie even that we did on this show a year ago.
Well, what I said just on the Goonies tip, which I think bears repeating here, is that even while talking about Goonies after I'd seen what was in fact a very bad movie, I said in an hour, I will still like Goonies the same as I did before watching it. I just don't like the movie I just watched, but Goonies is still great to me. And so I think that the nostalgia has a way of doing that, and Back to the Future 2 is certainly in that camp. I am and was legitimately excited to watch this film. It may very well not be good, but I do remember the highlights, the fun stuff, like the double time travel, you know, Marty McFly stuff is fun to me.
Absolutely.
It sounds fun,
like,
in my head
right
now.
Let's just pretend it's a bad movie. We'll find out it's a bad movie. The crazy thing is, there's so many iconic images and moments from this bad movie. If it's a bad movie, it's crazy that there's this many memorable things in a bad movie. And one of the weird things about Back to the Future, my entire life, I guess I was 5 or 6 when this came out, when Back to the Future 2 came out, which is, by the way, the year of or the year after Roger Rabbit. So this is the film he makes right after Roger Rabbit. And I didn't know that. I didn't know, you know, who made Roger Rabbit. But it's interesting that this comes, he is at peak fucking powers. Like, this guy is so talented. And yet so my point being that as a little kid, I only knew Back to the Future as a trilogy. I only knew that there were three movies. And so ever since it's ever existed, really, and I've watched it many, many times, I kind of watch it or consider it a trilogy, even though I think of 2 and 3 as basically a pair of sequels to this great first movie. But that's something I had to arrive at intellectually much later.
Yeah.
And as a kid, I was like, yeah, there's 3 Back to the Future movies, and, you know, they're all of some equal worth and weight.
The last time I saw it was the last time I mentioned on the last podcast, which was Arclight Cinema did all 3 back to back to back. One day, the cast and, you know, everybody showed up for Q&A. It was so fun. And watching those movies in a row, was awesome. It didn't flag for me. I remember, too, not being maybe as fun. But, like, it was a great day. There was no point at which I was like, oh, Matrix Reloaded. Like, it was none of that shit was happening. Right. It was all pretty fun and interesting to me. Also, this happened last week, and I was very I was kind of happy we decided to do this podcast today, because I was in Seattle last week. And I went to the Museum of Popular Culture, which used to be EMP, and they have this sci-fi floor, basically, where you go in. And a big part of one of the walls are the three hoverboards from Back to the Future 2. And I was looking at it, and it was cool, and they showed some clips from Back to the Future 2, and I was like looking at the jacket he wore and the hoverboards and, the famous sneakers. This kid walked up, who couldn't have been more than 7, and went, "Back to the Future!" And they were so stoked about it. And they sat and they were looking at the hoverboards. And they knew what those were. And they knew like what those meant. And I stared at that kid and I was thinking, not many movies have that staying power for a 7-year-old today to be like, I know what that is. I know what movie it's from. And I love it. And I'm excited to show my mom. Like, Mom, Back to the Future. Come see. That's cool.
But perfect point, because it's not Back to the Future. It's Back to the Future 2, which is, you know, this very – like, I as I've gotten older, I've sort of determined that Back to the Future 2 and 3 is essentially Back to the Future 2 and Back to the Future 2 Part 2. Like, they're, those are sequels. Those are their own thing, very separate from the original Back to the Future. But as a kid, that was exactly my relationship. I couldn't remember if the hoverboard was in the first movie or in the third. Like, I had no idea. I couldn't remember. It all felt like the same thing. And only as I've gotten older have I differentiated between the two. There was something else I wanted to say about all that, too, which is – one of the things we said about Back to the Future 1 was – what a marvel of economy it is as far as being a time travel film. I mean, it's so easy. We said that we've worked on writing a time travel movie. We're actually working on writing another time travel movie. And it's very easy to get stuck in the weeds of time travel mechanics and rules and how all this shit works. And Back to the Future 1 super elegantly gets around all of that stuff. It states its rules very clearly. Then it's just payoff after payoff after payoff, brilliant twist after brilliant twist, genius move after genius move. Back to the Future 2, in my head, and I believe its reputation, and we'll find out, is that it gets deeply mired in the minutiae of time travel rules and inconsistencies and whatever, paradoxes. And that is what it is used to fuel itself. So it'll be very interesting to watch that.
I am interested in that too, and I do think that Bob Gale, who was at the Q&A and sort of talked semi-eloquently about this, I think he doesn't always know what the right thing to focus on is my experience of watching his movies, or his scripts, I guess. And Zemeckis just tends to like move things forward, and I think he's very focused on the feel, the audience feel, and the experience of watching the story. I don't know that Bob Gale has that same instinct, and it does not surprise me. And I do remember that sort of the minutia of he goes back here, and then this is the choreography of this. It's very mechanical as opposed to emotional and propulsive.
Well,
and
there's there's a mega scene where Doc Brown pulls up a chalkboard and starts mapping the futures and the times.
I feel like you're always in trouble if that scene's in your script.
Well, that's what I'm interested to see. If that's trouble, I don't know. I mean, like, this movie, I want to go into it. It's weird because even though we set it up that way, my ideal situation here is to say, yes, Back to the Future is the classic. So what is this? And to not have this, the brilliance of Back to the Future 1 necessarily splash negatively on Back to the Future 2. Like, maybe there's a way to just forge these as very, very different films.
Yeah, and we haven't even mentioned the thing I'm probably most excited about, which is getting to spend time with Michael J. Fox again. I'm really stoked about that. I was thinking of, this doesn't matter, but I was thinking about Dirty Dancing this morning.
This will be our fourth Michael J. Fox movie.
And I was thinking about Patrick Swayze. And I just thought, I just want to spend time with Patrick Swayze. That's the main reason I want to watch Dirty Dancing again. And I was hoping we draw that at some point. But then I thought, I really want to spend time with fucking Michael J. Fox again. Because even if the movie sucks, I just like hanging out with that guy. And even though Doc Hollywood, not the musical, but the movie, was not necessarily a good movie, I liked being with that guy. I thought it was so fun to hang out with that dude. So that's part of the experience I'm looking forward to now.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I again, I'm just contradicting myself all over the place, because the other thing is, I want to see how this builds on or evolves or loses the magic of the brilliant chemistry in the first movie. I mean, like, that we kept saying on that, and I'm sorry to do this, but it really is worth listening to. I think it's a cool episode, and there's a lot of insightful stuff about Back to the Future in that other episode. But we kept talking about the alchemy of these elements, and Zemeckis as this extraordinary orchestrator of energy. visual energy, plot energy, character energy, and that they aren't obvious fits, and yet they all congeal into this masterpiece. And so it's very risky. And I think this is why filmmakers used to not do this, to revisit something that's magic. Because how do you know that you're not going to fuck it up and you're not going to then have it, you know, negatively impact the memory of that other film? And I don't think Back to the Future has ruined the memory of Back to the Future 1 on any level, but it is, you know, people always, they get a little cringy or a little waffly about whether it's worth anything.
That's actually a good place to leave it, and it's very interesting, which is the society has decided that Matrix Reloaded and Revolution sucks, and Matrix is awesome. That's what we've all collectively been like, yeah, that's the way that is. We've all agreed that the Raiders of the Lost Ark first trilogy is great. Like, we all say it's great. Yeah, Temple of Doom's dark, whatever, but we all stand by it. Society, I don't think, has made a decision about Back to the Future 2. Yeah. The public opinion still weirdly feels split about this movie.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that applies to any other sequel or trilogy that I can think of right now.
Not one that is sort of generally unsettled. I mean, there's lots of trilogies that people have rejected or, you know, try to embrace in sort of sideways. But this one, I think it's a really cool thing to say.
Yeah, it's good to think about. And even Aliens, which I think Aliens 2 obviously has a different feel than Alien, Aliens has a different feel than Alien. I think that society has settled into what it thinks about that distinction and those differences in those directors. I don't think we've decided what to do with Back to the Future 2. So maybe we should just be the ones to decide that for society.
We'll decide right
now. Are you comfortable with
that? Totally, very.
All right, we're going to go do that.
Hey, McFly! Yeah, I've seen you around. You're Marty McFly's kid, aren't you? Beth? You're Marty Jr. Tough break, kid. Must be rough being named after a complete butthead.
What's that supposed to mean?
Hello? Hey. Hello, anybody home? Huh? Think, McFly, think! Your old man, Mr. Loser.
What?
That's right. Loser with a capital L.
Look, I happen to know George McFly is...
No, I'm not talking about George McFly. I'm talking about his kid. Your old man, Marty McFly Sr., the man who took his life and flushed it completely down the toilet.
I did? I mean, he did.
Hey, Grams! I told you, 2 coats of wax on my car, not just one!
All right, we're going to settle it for all time.
I don't know if I can settle it.
Yeah, I have no clear thoughts. I have a couple clear thoughts that are not helpful about that debate. But
okay, let's start there.
Let's challenge ourselves to settle it by the end.
Well, can I say something meta that's funny? Is like
Is it about old man makeup?
No, but that's funny. I shouldn't have seen this coming. But it's an absurd challenge to try to level to us to say let's treat this like an independent movie. It's ridiculous idea because it is It is aggressively not that.
No.
It is determined to make you think of the first film from the very first second. And so that's...
And also determinedly setting up the third constantly.
Yeah, right.
Now, it's a very strange movie. I'm not sure I know of a... I certainly don't know of a movie that ends with a trailer for the third in the movie itself. It's we'll get to that, but it's a very confusing scenario. I will say, as a way of opening the conversation, that... While we were aware, I was certainly aware that Crispin Glover was demanding equal pay and equal billing as Michael J. Fox, I didn't remember how much Tom Wilson is in this movie and how fun that dude is.
Oh, yeah.
I like that dude quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. This is a super showcase for
Thomas Wilson.
He's
doing all the stuff, man. Tom Wilson is doing all the things he's supposed to do in this movie, and he's on screen almost as much as Michael J. Fox, I would say, time-wise. He's on screen a lot.
Yeah.
And I liked it. And I liked every time he was on screen.
I didn't like every time he was on screen.
I did. I liked
you,
it.
You just liked it straight
up? I liked
it
because...
What did you think of the movie? I mean, we'll get to Thomas Wilson because there's lots to say.
I mean,
about
my way... I kind of feel the same way about Thomas Wilson I feel about the movie. There are moments he is egregious on screen. Like, so big and crazy and sort of ostensibly unfunny. I liked that stuff.
Oh.
I liked that stuff that he was doing because it was like gave me something to do.
Okay, so you like is that so you say that parallels your thoughts of the movie? Did you like the movie?
I didn't really like the movie. If I'm being honest, I was not bored. I didn't have a good time. It struck me about an hour and 15 minutes into the movie that the movie could theoretically go on forever, Because there wasn't a good sense of where we were at in the story, and just obstacles kept coming up. It was a Three Stooges show after a while, and I didn't feel a sense of narrative arc or pacing. It just felt kind of wild and all over the place. So structurally, I was not pleased with it, but I was fine. I liked hanging out in that universe. There are some things we should get into that are terrible storytelling.
It's funny that you talk about the structure, because the thing that I found the most intellectually engaging about the movie that I didn't quite remember as an experiential thing, is it's just it. Its structure is disorganized because it's telling its story out of order. Mm-hmm. It's like kind of experimental in that it will set things up with their payoff, and then the payoff is the setup. Like, it constantly does this, and it's sort of doing it all the time. And so it doesn't really. I think that there are basic, just sort of fundamental kind of scene and energy problems in the movie, but that idea is pretty cool.
Kind of as a conceptual idea. Yeah. But the way it manifests is that it's payoffs tend to come as a punch, and then setups generally take time.
Yeah.
And so what you have is a punch, and then later you'll have a slow rolling setup that you'll feel, and there's no moment of catharsis to that.
No, it's super well. So what we're talking about, I mean, very quickly, the plot of the movie is there's essentially three big sequences in the film. One is they go to the future to try to fix a problem with Marty's kids, which seems like the setup for the film. It is not. It is a short adventure in the future, which essentially, I didn't remember this, all takes place in the courtyard, the sort of main street area that we know from the first film, and Marty's future house. And that's the whole future sequence.
Can I say something about that?
Mm-hmm.
I was watching the scene, and I thought, what a great gimmick to have, because in a time travel film, you don't really have to rush anywhere. When Doc Brown comes back and is like, we gotta go to the future, we gotta talk to your kids, we gotta save your kids, all he has to do is set the clock back in 20 minutes, and then he won't have to rush when he gets to the time, right? That's all he has to do, really.
Right.
But and that's a problem for pacing, because it's not interesting to watch a guy land in the future go, we got an hour and a half to set this up, you gotta go get that kid, I'm gonna go do this, don't worry about it, we got plenty of time. Right. Instead, they get there and they have to frantically rush around. What they've done, though, by making Doc Brown such a wild nutcase, is they've sort of excused it. You're like, yeah, he's just, that's the way he is. He's a mad scientist, and it's a way around a pacing problem inherent to the idea.
Yeah, that's true. But this is getting into a different topic than what I wanted to talk about. But maybe my biggest issue with the whole movie is that Doc Brown is a different character, and in this movie, he is much more the gag, I guess, of what the setup to Rick and Morty is. He's a exposition machine. And the only reason it's kind of entertaining, kind of, is because Christopher Lloyd is funny and cool. But he's not a good character in this movie. In fact,
he's
a horrible
caricature.
Character.
And actually, I didn't enjoy him in this film.
No, I didn't either. But let me finish what I was going to say, which is that he goes to the future. They solve the problem of the kids, but that causes more problems. Then they have to go back to 1985, where they realize that by future Biff traveling back to 1955, they've caused a problem in 1985.
Future Biff stole the DeLorean somehow. It doesn't matter. Went back.
So while they were in the future, old Biff, really old Biff, goes back and meets really young Biff from the first movie, but we don't know all this. We just sort of intuit it. I'm getting tangled up talking about this movie.
I can't wait to watch you unfold this.
So they go to 1985, they realize everything's fucked up and that they have to go back to 55 to stop old Biff from giving young Biff a sports almanac that allows young Biff to become rich Biff in 1985. Okay, basically that's what happened.
Old Biff, young Biff, and Rich
the
Biff.
all to say, the setup for all of this, you see the setup for the film, the problems that have been created throughout the entire movie, in the last third of the film. So everything that they're unraveling from 1985 onward is set up after that sequence. And it's really weird because when you put it back together, and so my point is the 1955 scenes are slow. They are paced like a normal movie. And the 85 scenes are paced like the third act frenzy of the repercussion of the normal movie. And it's really weird that they do that frenzy where you're not engaged before the setup. But weird as it is, it's pretty cool to try that. It kind of fails. And it's like, oh, yeah, no shit. Like, setting something up before you pay it off is better storytelling. But it's cool that they tried not to do it, because you can sort of reassemble the movie in your head, and it maybe feels a little bit better in a weird way.
And there's fun in that. Like, that's part of, I guess, the afterglow of the film is sort of tracking through different timelines and working through what happened. It's not complicated. It's sort of fun. It's engaging. But also, one of the feelings you get from that structure and from the way the movie is just sort of plotted is you get the sense that, oh, there could be an infinite number of scenes of two guys trying to fix small mistakes they made in different time frames to get back to the time frame they want. Yeah. That it could be an infinite number of movies. And when that feeling sets in, which they kind of dig you out of when things start to happen that are more engaging, you start to get really like, oh, okay, I guess this could go on forever. And I just don't like the feeling.
Well, was
that.
There ever a point where... I shouldn't ask you this. I'll just tell you what I'm trying to get at. When they go back to 1955, the movie achieves clarity, and I like it. Mm-hmm. I really like it. The whole film basically is referencing the original movie. Mm-hmm. All through the movie, they're riffing on what we know and love from the now classic Back to the Future, which in a weird way dates this movie very badly, because it tells you exactly when it came out. It's making jokes about itself in a way that the original Back to the Future, of course, didn't. So in a way, this movie is its own exercise in nostalgia and
big time
and self-worship in a way. I mean, they're even joking about each other's success. Like, Jaws 19 is in the film,
directed by Max Spielberg.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what it says on the
movie. Oh, that's crazy. Yeah. And there's references, like, you see Roger Rabbit in there's a Roger Rabbit toy in the movie. So, like, they're like luxuriating in their own triumph, which is uncomfortable and weird and dates the movie badly. Whereas Back to the Future feels timeless, even though it's set in 1985, this suddenly by being set 4 years previously is like all about 80s jokes. It feels way more, I guess my point is, it feels way more 80s than Back to the Future does.
Oh,
which is totally,
yeah,
weird.
And part of that's intentional and part of it's not, you right. know, they're riffing on their own era, and that's supposed to be sort of funny and clever or whatever,
but wait, oh fuck, sorry, I just sorry, derailed sorry. This movie's gonna do this to me. I just derailed the whole point I was gonna make. Something about how by the time it gets to so the future sequence is re-ironing over all the things that happened to Marty in that same location in the first movie. Mm-hmm. So it's the same chase with Biff, although now it's Biff's grandson, Griff, and Marty is playing his own grandson, and they're going through all the beats. And the joy of the sequence is supposed to be, remember that great, how much fun that was. Well, now we've put it in the future. So that I felt was unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. The part that is wildly successful to me is when they go back into Back to the Future, the movie, and Marty is trying to dodge and weave throughout the events of that movie. I think that is totally brilliant.
Well, I touched on this in the intro, and I wish I would have unpacked it more, because it turns out most of what I remember from Back to the Future 2, with some side like images of evil Rich Biff future, or 1985 version, was Michael J. Fox avoiding old Michael J. Fox and seeing those events from a different angle. That's actually most of what I remembered, which is not a bulk of this film, really.
Well, but it's a big sequence. I mean, what I remembered most vividly, even though I've seen this movie enough times to know all the parts, is the future. And watching it now, I was like, as a kid, and we were watching it with Dallas. Dallas was here. He's like two. In fact, he got so worked up that he slapped Travis.
I mean, he hit my arm.
He hit him. He hit him because of all the punching and chasing in this movie. He got really worked up. But he loved this future. He loved that whole sequence because it's so flashy and exciting. And then he sort of tuned out. Like, he kind of left the room. But as a kid, I remember being like, yeah, the future stuff is where it's at. That's why you see Back to the Future 2. He goes to the fucking future. Like, you see some crazy shark holograms. Like, he flies around on a hoverboard.
Yeah, self-lacing Nikes.
Yeah, these power-laced Nikes. Like, there's funny, quote-unquote funny stuff with seeing like old him and like his own, he plays his own daughter. You know, there's a lot of like wacky stuff that is not tonally consistent with the original Back to the Future, not funny, unto itself, but certainly frantic and like kind of memorable, I guess.
I remember being a kid actually and seeing, I guess, a preview or something. I think I saw Back to the Future 2 in the theater. It's very possible. And I remember the idea that Michael J. Fox, this is like amped up a lot higher in the lead up to the film. I remember like the idea he would play his own sister or play his daughter and his son and himself as older version. I thought that was so funny and so cool as a kid. I couldn't wait. I remember being so amped to see that. And the movie plays to that. The only shot they have of Michael J. Fox playing his own daughter is she in the moment turns to camera and the camera like lets the audience laugh for a second. Like it's built in to be like, look how funny that is.
Yeah.
And it's whatever. It's fine.
It's weird because you have to try, like I kept trying during the future sequence to get into the new rhythm of this movie, which is very different. But I gotta say, again, and this is in the way that Back to the Future 2 revisits Back to the Future, Back to the Future 2, the podcast on Does Your Favorite Movie Suck is going to revisit our podcast about Back to the Future 1.
I don't like
where
you're going with this.
But listening to us talk about Back to the Future 1 and its perfect orchestration by a director, that is largely, if not almost completely absent for me from the first two-thirds or so of this movie. And then, weirdly, it super kicks into gear when he goes to 55. And, I mean, I was really watching this being like, is this just me, you know, loving the nostalgia factor of seeing the original Back to the Future? And somehow I don't think so. It feels like his heart is suddenly in it again when he goes into the joy of integrating into his own old movie.
I think, yeah, that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it, I think, might be that to me, there's an emotional core to Back to the Future 1, which is about Marty and Doc Brown's friendship and relationship. That's an emotional anchor. He goes back. There's a real moment when he has to go back to the future and look at Doc's dying body. And, you know, there's moments of emotion there. There's moments of emotion with his mother and trying to get his mother and father together. There's things that really anchor yourself in a character way, in an emotional way, in the first movie. This one is more about a thing, which is stop the sports almanac from getting to this, from this hand to this hand, and tracing an object around. And it's about, you know, your nemesis Biff in multiple generations. It's not about friendships or relationships in the same way as the first one. So I found myself less invested in the mechanics, which were also shot worse and sort of more convoluted and things. But are you saying
that's why it's cool to go back to 1955?
No, I'm saying that partly, in that it resonates the things I cared about from those relationships. By showing me in the background of the shot, George McFly punching Biff Tannen, I'm like, oh, it felt great when that happened. Like, it did click me back into the emotions. And when I see the Enchantment Under the Sea dance from different angles and see George McFly and Lorraine dancing, that makes me so happy. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, in a way, it does clue me back into those emotions in a way that, like, hooks me back into the story. It's partly what you were saying, but for me, partly also that it's resonance of enjoyment of a film, but also there was something to hang my hat on that felt nice from a character standpoint, which I didn't
really
have.
Yeah, well, but I mean, it's important to say that even though the movie is obsessed with itself, its own, you know, previous film, that doesn't bug me. What bothered me for the first half plus, it was the lack of orchestration. It felt like it's sort of swamped in special effects and blue screen in a way that is sort of, it doesn't feel beautiful. It feels clunky. And it feels like you for all the joy of watching these characters, these actors perform in Back to the Future 1, where they're wild body movements and, you know, exaggerated expressions and the camera flowing around and the cars zipping around in these beautiful, incredible ways. All of it fell off, you know, and for example, we both sort of, I think it's a good fall, but like there's a scene where Elizabeth Shue sees herself and old her goes, I'm young, and young her goes, I'm old, and they fall in opposite directions. It should work. It's a big, bold, broad idea with a good fall. But it doesn't feel good.
Joy is the right word, man. It felt joyless to me, and Back to the Future 1 feels joyful. That's really the core of that.
And yet, when they go to 1955, he finds it again. It gets joyful. The things like the same delight and the same experimentation with special effects, to me, suddenly you get engaged. Like, there's a long sequence where old Biff talks to young Biff, and it's shot through the front windshield of the car, of Biff's car, And they're sitting, one sitting in the driver's seat, one sitting in the passenger seat. And the camera is slow pushing in on each one of them. It's hiding little seams of special effects, but it's two Thomas Wilsons engaging in a dynamic conversation with himself. And they're passing back this book. They're flipping it around the car. Marty McFly is popping up in the background. It's a lot of single shots that are very hard to pull off. And even though it's flashy, it was joyful to me. I was like, this is the guy and his powers. This is what Robert Zemeckis can do. He makes special effects fun. And somehow it invites you into the fun, even though you can kind of see the filmmaking at work. And I noticed that in Back to the Future 1 a lot. Mm-hmm. And here, suddenly, when they go back to that era, he finds it again. And I don't know what is up with that. It was very weird to watch and be like, there he is. That's that guy. How come he waited this long to engage? And something about the cynicism and the sort of goofy, dark jokes of the first two chunks, it just feels like he doesn't like it.
Yeah, I think especially you feel that, not just content-wise, but tone-wise and pacing-wise, is in the alternate 1985, when they come back from the future. Biff has now stolen the journal, the sports almanac, and so Rich Biff is now in power. It's really, content-wise, much darker than I remember it being.
It's dark is, you know, we talked about Temple of Doom, and I thought about it a lot. It's different.
It's a different darkness.
It's not, the problem
it's,
is...
You know what it is? It's Bob, so Bob Gale, we talked about this on the first one, I'm sure. I haven't listened back to it, but Bob Gale is a weird optimist guy. Like, he is a pie in the sky, you know, human nature is great kind of guy, at least in person, in interviews I've seen, and in scripts I've read of his. His version of bad is also super weird to me. Like, it'd be okay if it was like Tim Burton Batman bad. Like, it'd be okay if it was, you know, flaming barrels or like Jumanji bad, like flaming barrels and hobos and stuff. His version of bad is bikers, I guess, sewer treatment plants, domestic abuse, gaslighting. It's like weird things that aren't, there aren't crazy, they aren't funny, they're just sad and weird.
Totally. And it's really weird that that's the tone that they strike.
Were you surprised by that in the moment when that scene was happening? Because I kept being shocked by the things he chose to do.
I guess I was surprised if I thought about it, but I was mostly like, it's gross. I bet this didn't play then, but it really plays badly now. For a movie that is high octane fun and adventure, it is not fun to watch a young guy in middle-aged man makeup beat up Leah Thompson.
Yeah, Leah Thompson's got breast implants that he made her get. She's sad. Her old woman makeup sucks and is saggy-faced and weird. Yeah. And, like, he throws her around, and then she tells her son, hey, you know, it's my fault. I shouldn't have talked back to him.
Well, you get exactly what they wanted
totally
to do.
Totally get on paper what is happening.
Yeah, and I'm curious.
It just doesn't play.
It's strange how badly it plays. It doesn't. It's not. It doesn't work. And even because the tone is off, even though this is a different kind of movie, and you see how this should work, there's sequences where Biff is like shooting a gun at Marty, and it's just like, no, yeah. Wrong. I don't want to watch somebody be threatened by bullets in this series. It just doesn't really work the same. There's a similar sequence where some punks drive by the principal Strickland's house, and they drive by and they shoot machine guns at his house. And it's like, I don't know why, but it's unpleasant in a way that isn't like unpleasant.
It's shot weird, and it's not crazy enough to be funny. And like, oh man, this version of Hill Valley is really shitty. It's like a drive-by machine guns to an ex-principal who's also wearing like a
bulletproof vest, and which sounds wild and funny, but it isn't. And the same thing in this sequence when Marty, and I know other people have pointed this out, and so it's not me. And actually, it didn't bother me as bad as I thought it was gonna when I remembered what was about to happen. But Marty goes to his own house now in super shitty town. And who's living in his house? A black family. Mm. And that is sort of an instant signifier of poverty.
Yeah.
And it's, again, no joy there. No, nothing fun about it.
It's supposed to be hijinksy when the dad comes in and sees a white man in the bedroom broken into his daughter's room, and he swings a bat at him, and he's Marty McFly is dodging the bat. It's supposed to, I guess, be wild and wacky. It is not funny, and it's not engaging or enjoyable. In that way.
And even if it was going, if they're obviously going for super duper cartoon nightmare, you know, present, like it's basically post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, there's bikers everywhere, Kieran.
And yet it's everywhere. It's not. I wonder. One of the things I wondered during both the future sequence and this sequence, and again, something that is remedied in the 55 stuff, or at least altered in 55, is they're moving so fast through everything that there's no time to clock what they're trying to do. Like, you kind of get it in your head because we've seen movies before, but it's so poorly executed.
I mean, you mentioned this earlier. Two things about execution. Speed. Yeah, well, all the exposition is done through Doc Brown rapid fire, Gatling gunning off some stuff. Like, okay, we have to go get this because this, otherwise this will happen, and we gotta go. And then they go. And you're like, okay, fine. But that's how all of the exposition seems to be handled. And it's, Kalen said it's enjoyable because of the performance. Yeah, that's kind of true, I guess. It's not super enjoyable in that way.
But it's not even going for pleasure. Like, there's once in a while they will acknowledge kind of how ridiculous this is. And, like, there's one shot that I loved and laughed at where I don't even remember what time period they're in, but Doc is on a rant. And they blocked it in a way where he's delivering exposition as he walks toward the camera looking into the distance. Yeah. And Marty is behind him trying to keep up. And he starts staring into the distance, even though there's nothing to look at. And I didn't explain that well. But there's some of their expressions are in keeping with the original film, which are very, very funny.
Christopher Lloyd's great. I mean, and I will say, I think the chalkboard thing was fine.
Yeah, yeah. That wasn't as complicated as I remember.
And it's a pretty good explanation I was going to say
it's a good explanation for something you don't care about.
This is what I was going to say in the intro, is that it needs, for that beat to work, it has to not really matter that much. And it has to be super simple. And it has to be pleasurable to see it visually, even if you already understand it. And it was all those things to me.
You know what I think the biggest, you know what I think now that we're talking about it, the biggest problem with this movie is, actually, it's overstuffed, but you could have trimmed all that out by taking out some of the action sequences, taking out some of the unpleasantness with Biff. What it's missing is a conflict between Marty and Doc.
Yeah.
That's what it needs.
Well,
if it's going to be a Marty-Doc movie.
It's not, though.
But it is.
It's not, but it should be. This is my main complaint about it.
But I mean that they are our protagonists.
They should be, yeah. I mean,
who else is it?
I mean, I think it's a Marty-Biff film, because Marty realizes and says, if I hadn't made this mistake, Doc just delivers Marty to and from places, as far as I'm concerned. Like, Marty makes a mistake by being greedy and trying to change his shitty future by getting an almanac. He sets that chain of events in place.
Right.
Doc has nothing to do with that. Doc just says, don't do that. And Marty does it anyway. So who fucking cares what Doc says? So Doc just delivers Marty to his next conflict with Biff. To me, it's a Marty Biff doubleheader. I don't see Doc as even being part of the film. And my main complaint is that,
right.
is that what the first movie is a core emotional center between those two characters, and their relationship was awesome and it mattered to them.
Well, they have a very minor amount of conflict in Back to the Future 1. That's not really obviously we know this. That's not really the plot there either. But in this case, that would have gone a long way toward finding an emotional route, because Biff is a cartoon. He's just a big, ridiculous cartoon.
I will say a fun cartoon most of the time.
Sometimes fun, yeah. I mean, especially when he's a young man. Like, I laughed super... Like, again, I laughed hella hard when you threw... No, when he's playing young Biff.
Oh. when he's fucking with the kids?
When he comes out of his house good. And there's some kids, and he takes their ball and throws it on the roof of another house. And he goes like, go get it. And like, I was like, that's funny.
That's
like,
great.
There's something really funny about him as that version of Biff. But if they were going to do Marty Biff, they needed to deepen his rivalry with Biff, but they can't really do that, because Biff's problem is not Marty. It never is. I mean, they sort of pretend it is by the end of the movie, and they sort of, obviously they're looking toward that for part three when he has to fight Mad Dog Tannen.
It's weird because they're doing things they don't really have to do in this film. Like, there's a moment which ostensibly happens in all timelines where Biff confronts Lorraine, and she's just bought her dress for the Enchantment Under the Sea dance. And he goes over and he grabs the dress and is like very aggressive with her. And he's like, who are you going to the dance with? Is it me? And she says, no, I'm going with Calvin Klein. And then he like physically kind of assaults her. She kicks him and runs off. And he has this very intense acting moment where he says, I'm going to marry you one day. It's meant to be. I'm going to marry you. And I kept thinking, like, this happens in all the timelines, and this is weird and doesn't have to be here for this plot.
Well, and it's interesting now that we're talking about this to see how the movie tries to force Marty into the middle of this problem. I mean, let's remember, Biff is created as an antagonist for George McFly, mm-hmm. and Marty kind of involves himself in that conflict. But he is resolving the conflicts of his parents. And so they keep trying to put Marty in a position to be the protagonist to Biff's antagonist. And what's weird is that antagonist Biff doesn't give a fuck about Marty. Mm-hmm. He's like, he's sort of like vaguely alludes to him as like a kid's going to cause you problems or whatever. But Biff's real rival is George, who's not in the movie, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it probably would have benefited in this way by, if they were going to make Biff the bad guy, they needed to keep George around on
Biff,
some level.
Biff sort of doesn't know Marty exists. Like the timeline they coexist in, he was a butthole to his father, and then he worked for his father. That's the two engagements they have in the first movie,
right,
in the same sort of timeline where Biff would know who Marty is. So you're right. It is weird that they try to play them as the antagonist, but there's the movie's stretching for that equanimity, because what happens in the 1985 Rich Biff scenario is that Marty has this emotional moment where he realizes, oh my God, Biff is my dad. Biff Tannen is my fucking dad. And it's supposed to be weighty and create some of this other conflict they're looking for. It doesn't work or do that.
Well, they rocket right past that moment because Biff then says, he's not my kid. And so you're immediately out of that.
Like, okay, yeah.
Like he doesn't.
And then he explains how and where he got the almanac for plot reasons, and then tries to shoot Marty.
But once again, that's a scene that should have been some way to deepen their conflict. And it does it only on the most basic surface level, which is you want to stop me from being a rich guy, I guess.
Yeah, but also he's already rich. Like it doesn't.
I know
make
why.
A lot of
why
sense.
In that
it doesn't
sequence.
Make any. It's yeah. it. That's the thing is with Bob Gale, I really think you can always see the levers moving, and with Zemeckis, you know, doing his thing, I don't think you can always see that. I always know what Bob Gale's trying to do, and I always feel like I know if he's succeeding or failing in the moment. I'm not usually lost in a Bob Gale script.
Well, yeah. You mean a Zemeckis script? Lost. What do you mean? You're
I mean,
lost.
Bob Gale wrote this. Yeah. Lost in it. Like, I'm not thinking about that stuff. Like, lost in it, enjoying it,
not thinking about
the mechanics of the wheels turning.
I see.
Will say, as a microcosm of that, and this is a very negligible pedantic point, but I think it's illustrative for me. Like, in Back to the Future 1, you wouldn't have so much of the plot relying on a character not turning around or hearing something. But so much of the, and back me up here, Kaylin, so much of this film depends on a character not hearing something very audible or not turning around.
Yes, but I like that.
You do not
yes,
like
I do.
That.
I like it.
That much of it?
Yeah.
That's, defend that to
I
me.
I like, I think it's that's funny.
Insane.
I think all of those, almost all of those things are funny. Like
really?
Because
one of them is funny to me.
Because here's the version of Back to the Future 2 that I want is the one that is being a hyperactive cartoon of Back to the Future, which is already wildly cartoony in its gestures. But Back to the Future 2 is sort of saying, well, let's make this a fully intellectual experience where we're turning the energy up to 12. You know, like we're going all the way off the charts with the energy and the pace and the cartoony nature of this. And it's all going to be frenetic. And so in that version of things, I like the cartoony setups of there's a guy who's 2 inches from this person. It's movie-y to me.
Yeah, but it's not shot that way. Like, it's not. I'm okay with, like, a cartoon, like, two people turning at the same time and just happening to miss seeing the thing they're supposed to see. It's not that, man. It's just mechanical. It doesn't feel joyful or interesting.
To me, it does in the like, Strickland scene. Like, when he goes.
That's the only one I like.
You like that?
I said I liked one of those moments. The Strickland scene's the only one I like.
So I felt like that was.
That's great. I have no beef with
that. That was the best of them all.
Okay,
but,
well, I have no beef with that one.
Yeah.
But it happens 40 other times.
So do you want to describe any of these things so people know a little bit better?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you the one that happens over and over again, which is Marty McFly for an hour is trying to get this almanac out of Biff's pocket or dashboard or front seat, depending on the moment of the film. And he spends a lot of time either hanging behind the car on a skateboard or hoverboard or in the back seat under a blanket or in a different scene, not under a blanket. It happens a lot, you guys.
Where he's less than a foot away from the person who is trying to get him. Basically.
So all Biff has to do is turn around or often look in his rearview mirror. That's it. And the movie's over. Which I get. I'm with Kalen. That could be funny. That could be a funny gag to play an amp and get acknowledge that it's crazy and happens over and over again. I would argue the movie does not do that. And it just has to do it mechanically to build the plot and get the plot going that Marty's trying to get this as they move to a different location.
Can I offer a theory? I have a theory about this, and I'm very eager, and I hope that someday, if not right now, you know, we watch Back to the Future 3 for this show, because I really want to look at it. And my theory is this. So Zemeckis is coming off of Who Framed Roger Rabbit. This movie came out 1 year after Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which admittedly a lot of Who Framed Roger Rabbit was doing animation and shit. So I'm sure they shot it quite a while before it was actually released. So there was enough time to make this movie, which is a very elaborate film to make.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, this is not this on the surface. This is not Zemeckis taking a break. Like, he's not doing something small. He's doing something quite ambitious. And I feel like he was tired of making big effects movies. It feels like he's a little bit worn out. I think that's sort of the feeling I have. And what's funny is Back to the Future 3 is a movie that a worn out guy would make. I want to make something that still has adventure, but is kind of a chill out in the old West. Like, it's a big set, you know, there's a lot of effects, there's a big sets to build and lots of stuff to do. There's big train stunts and stuff, but it doesn't feel like Roger Rabbit is so hyperactive. Yeah. And this movie, and he is so good at that, that when this movie fails, I have to feel like there's some part of me that's like, he just couldn't. You can't keep doing this.
I kind of feel you. I mean, I think that the genesis of this was, okay, well, let's do two more movies. We're greenlit for 2 and 3. We go to the future and we go to the far past. What's a funny, like, recent fun past that Biff can still be involved in? Well, Biff's grandfather, Old West. Like,
I think another way to say this, I think he wanted to make part 3. I'm not sure how bad he wanted to make part 2.
That I buy. That's a okay. If that's what you're saying, I kind of
that's
kind of
what I
that.
Mean. Is like that's the excitement that he may have. I in my head, back part 3 is much better.
Yeah, it's what I remember. I think that's what the culture has also decided, I think.
I'm not sure that's true.
Really?
I think a lot of people are kind of down on 3 because they think it's boring. Like, I think that part of the party line on 3 is that it's dull.
I wonder if this is true. In my head, 3 has a more A to B linear plot. I was excited volunteered to do this plot because you can track it. It's not hard to track. It's not confusing. It is kind of crazy, though. And it is kind of like a wild...
Well, it's all plot. I mean, 3 has... Let's talk about what I believe 3 has. You know, just based on the clips that we just saw, I remember that these things are in the movie. It has a romance for Doc Brown, mm-hmm. a real romance, something that they get into. So they give him a story, for one. That's not in part 2. There is no George McFly, period. He's never existed. He's not on the radar. So it has a much more developed and direct antagonistic protagonist relationship between Marty and Mad Dog Tannen.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only one Biff. Like, and that's the other thing. It's one story.
That's what I'm saying. It's A to B. There's an A to B plot that you can know what they're doing at all points of the film.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like a million things could now happen and who cares?
And it feels much more directly, other than the setup, because they just cut out the setup and go straight to the... Well, actually, they don't. It's a much more... funny. It's way more consistent with how they built Back to the Future 1. It's almost the same, in fact. It's just that they don't have to introduce the concept of time travel. So it moves a little quicker in terms of Marty and Doc sending Marty back to the past. But it's the same setup.
But it's one, yeah. And it does the things I think 2 should have done, which is firm up a correlationship between Doc and Marty and have a clear antagonist in Biff. Like,
yeah.
That's just what a movie should do,
basically. Yeah.
And 3 does that and 1 does that, kind of.
Did they decide that 2 doesn't need to do that and they wanted to try something wilder?
No, like, I think they got stuck in a crazy plot. I think they got stuck. The first draft came in, it had all this wild stuff. There wasn't a lot of time for everything else. They said, let's make this wild and wacky with big colors and it'll be fun.
Well, you know what's funny? I very quickly looked up, I don't know how true this is, but I quickly looked, I wanted to see, like, Robert Zemeckis on Back to the Future 2, and I couldn't really find that, but I did find an article relating to Back to the Future 3, where if I'm reading it correctly, it suggests that the genesis was a Back to the Future 2 that ended in the Old West. And they decided, essentially, let's do 3 movies. Let's do 2 films. 1 is all this wild stuff. 3 is Old West. Like, they wanted to carve out the Old West as a film. And so this became this middle chapter, which is at once frantic and overpacked, but also spinning wheels. Yeah. Because they had a different idea for an ending. So I wonder even if they ever went back to 55 in their original idea for this. Mm. I wonder if that was a new third act that they piped in here in order to delay Old West or something.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, I'm happy the movie exists. And like the way he gets to Old West is whatever. It could have been at any point at any time. And so they could have made two in the Old West if they wanted. And I appreciate that they took the time to do all this stuff, because you do want to go to the future and you do want to see how time streams work, and it is fun to see Tom Wilson in 18 different character get-ups. I enjoyed that. So I'm glad it exists. I think it is, in my memory, it's certainly worse than one, and I think I would argue certainly worse than three, but I haven't seen three in a long time.
Right.
It's just shtick and shenanigans that don't always work, and I wish that they had worked, because on paper, a lot of these can work. I think it's fun. You can do a version of what Kalen's saying, which is like, you just miss seeing him 50 times. Like, there's a way of making that funny. I would argue the movie does not do that. And I think that actually holds true for a lot of the shtick that the movie's doing. That it, on paper, could work. It just didn't work.
I also think it doesn't work because they didn't. I don't want to be so remedial as to say it's because Robert Zemeckis didn't work on the script. Like, you know, Robert Zemeckis has written some clunky scripts in his time. Like, you know, he's not an unimpeachable writer or anything. But I don't think this was worked the same way. I think that this was everybody on some level, whether for reasons of greed or just, you know, self-congratulation, coasting. Yeah, and they didn't Spielberg probably didn't force them to do 50 fucking rewrites, and Kennedy Marshall probably didn't force them because they already made Back to the Future.
Yeah, like, it does feel like that. It feels underbaked and undercooked.
It's deeply underbaked through. And they didn't put in the human element. And I mean, again, we talked about this on the first podcast too, and I haven't read it, but the original draft of Back to the Future is full of little like weird jokes. Like there's much more in there that seems that it's more in this flavor of, you know, Marty setting up Rube Goldberg machines and, you know, shooting little things at his principals or whatever, like being much more wild and wacky in the conception as opposed to the execution.
Yeah.
And this one is wild and wacky in the concept, and it's, as a result, kind of stale
also,
in the execution.
Also with the Doc Brown Marty thing is that in most of the third act, all of the third act, Marty and Doc are separated, so they give them walkie-talkies so they can, like, talk to each other. But honestly, all Marty does is call Doc and say, pick me up here. Nope, I was wrong. Now pick me up here. Nope, I'm going over here now. Yeah. Follow me here. That's all he really does with it. And I guess the instinct to keep them in touch is important because that should be good.
Let me ask you this. What is the best Doc Brown scene in the whole movie?
Oh, I know that answer instantly. It's the part I couldn't wait to come up. Doc Brown, so old Doc Brown sends Marty in back into the future from the first film. And you see him dancing and having that moment of like, I fucking did it, man. I'm standing between the flaming tire tracks. You guys remember the scene. And then it's the perfect timing. He's so happy. He's just relaxed. And then Marty runs back out from around the corner. He's like, Doc, I need your help. I fucking love that scene.
Yeah,
I love Christopher Lloyd's performance.
What's funny is that's not what I was thinking of, but you're right.
I love that scene. Yeah. And I couldn't wait for it to come. I felt it coming. I was this is my favorite scene in the movie. What were you going to say?
I was going to say it's the scene where he talks to himself. And it's not a great scene, but there's something emotional about this scientist interacting with himself over a machine, and he can't really say who he is to himself, and he's trying to dodge things, but he sort of can't resist little in remarks about what he's doing. And I thought there was something really beautiful and sweet about his relationship to himself, given all the warnings he's given Marty about.
I love it. Yeah. No, I love it. It just made me sad that they didn't exploit Christopher Lloyd more in the film. Like, Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd, if you put them on screen together and give them something to do, it will be beautiful and it will be great. And the movie never does that. And it's kind of frustrating to me that, you know, three gives you more of that. And I'm excited to see if my memory is right at all about that relationship.
Yeah.
But I just kept hungering for that, because those moments of humanism that Doc Brown has, just they're awesome. They just make me sad that there's not more of them.
Yeah.
Because
how
hard is it to do? You have fucking powerhouses.
Yeah.
They have three awesome performers in this movie. I think Tom Wilson more so than even in one. Mm-hmm. You have Michael J. Fox and you have Christopher Lloyd. And they're just all of them feel underused to me.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And by the way, so is Lea Thompson.
Yeah.
She's barely even in the film. Like, yeah. It's almost a shame that they bothered to include her at all. And I was sort of like, why did they? Like, why did they treat her so badly, given how great she is in the first film?
Yeah, they fucking shat on her in this movie.
Yeah, it's really weird. Because she, why couldn't, is it because she just got hitched to Crispin Glover? So when they eliminated him, she got a shit role?
By the way, watching them in the Enchantment Under the Sea stuff, shooting around a Crispin Glover stunt double is fucking amazing. Like, they got a guy to get a shitty haircut, basically, and shoot him from the back the entire time. It's really weird.
It's they made some odd choices. Like, they even overdub some of his lines with a bad Crispin Glover impersonator to match the Crispin Glover impersonator who plays him in the future.
Which is not a great impression, BTW. No.
Well, because nobody can do Crispin Glover. Like, why did they? Like, I don't know.
This is very telling.
If what you said is true, that this is sort of about insulting Crispin Glover, it's even more unpleasant.
And then they go to his gravestone. Like, yeah. I forgot about that. That I feel like that all is true. But this is very telling about Crispin Glover is that I think one of the only lines in the film that's actually him from the original film, unless I'm wrong, is when he reaches out his hand to
no, overdubbed.
That made me laugh.
That they overdid it?
No, what was the line?
He says, "Are you okay?"
Yeah, I thought that was so funny.
Well, it's funny in the first movie, and his delivery of it is blazed in my mind because it's so powerful, where he's like shaking and he's breathing hard.
Well, it happens off camera here.
Well, here it does, but it's with a different actor's voice.
Fuck.
It's weird. It's fucking weird. He never has a line. You see him in clips from the old film twice, weirdly, and then you never actually hear Crispin Glover's voice in the movie.
It's very frustrating.
It's just too bad. And mostly the victim here is
the audience.
Sometimes I want to call her Caroline Thompson because she played Caroline in The City.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah. It's funny. I used up all my Lea Thompson anecdotes on the last podcast.
Yeah. Don't bother. I'm not going
to
do it. Again.
I want to say this has been bugging me the whole time. I just have to say it's irrelevant to everyone. But Caitlin has this game called Clask. And I'm obsessed with the back of the box because tell me if this makes sense to anyone listening. Here's how this tries to explain the game. I'll read it as written. Get your hand under that table, !! Try to score, but watch out for the hole, period. Clask. What the fuck? Who wrote that?
Sounds exciting.
No, it sounds insane. Yeah. Sorry.
I don't know why that. Yeah, that is a weird box.
It's not well written, and I don't get it. Sorry, I don't mean to derail things, but that's really been on my mind.
Clask is a very fun game, everybody. You should play it. It's like a little home air hockey, but no electronics.
Does your favorite movie suck? Brought to you this week by Clask.
Oh, man. Wouldn't that be great?
If we got some money for this.
Let's just keep hammering on Clask for like the rest of the podcast.
Okay.
Let's see if we can get the attention of the Clask people.
I have no problem with that. Hashtag Clask.
Clask.
Anyway, that's all I have to say about Back to the Future 2, really.
Me too.
So I did enjoy it. I was not, for the most part, bored.
It won't let you not enjoy it. Like you have to really sink into your own. Just because it's so fast, you really have to stop and say, I'm not really enjoying this, because you would have to consciously think that.
Yeah, doesn't give
you
a second.
The movie's too aggressive to let you think that.
Yeah, future screenwriters, let that be a lesson to you.
Yeah,
don't give the audience a chance to realize they're not having a good time.
But in my so anyway, I don't feel like I have an answer.
I feel
to
like
our
I have an answer.
Question.
The movie's not good, but it gives you a fine feeling.
that's the final answer.
Yeah. No, here's the answer. It's not a good movie, is my answer.
I don't think ultimately, and I hate this. I think that this is a movie that is so tied to the response we would have to part three.
Yeah.
That it's like it's hard to. It doesn't even want you to analyze it as its own movie. I mean, like, Travis is right. The ending is they speed past the ending to the point where you don't even know it's the ending almost. Like, it's that great scene where Marty returns and he says, yeah, I'm back from the future and, you know, I need your help. Doc faints.
Awesome.
It says to be concluded on the screen.
It pans out.
And as the music is still rolling, like,
before credits,
like the feeling that you're supposed to have of like, whoo, what an adventure. It cuts right into, and it doesn't even tell you this is what you're watching. It cuts right into a shot of the Hill Valley clock tower and it says like Hill Valley and it pans up and you're in the Old West and you're like, oh fuck, I'm watching a trailer for the next movie.
Yeah, I've never seen
I'm
a
not
movie
even
do that.
Out of the emotional, they don't even want you to be out of the emotion of the past film.
No.
And so you're suddenly like, the trailer for part three is part of the emotional catharsis you have. And the catharsis is there's going to be more.
Yeah.
That's what you're supposed to feel at the end of part two.
Yeah, part two is a big commercial for part three. And it's not necessarily successful in storytelling in the conventional sense, but it does make me want to see part three.
Well, and once again, as another example of what it does, and this will be the last thing I say, I guess, because we'll pick this conversation up should we ever do part three, but
we will.
But it sets
You'll
it
fake
up
a pull.
The whole character arc of Marty is that there was a time in 1985 where somebody called him a chicken. And he made a and he did something that has set his whole life wrong. So you don't get that until literally the last, like the second to last scene of part three. So the setup for everything that is supposedly goes wrong in Marty McFly's life and the character, the thing Future he's Lorraine. Trying to work out doesn't, you don't get that moment until the end of the third film.
Yeah.
And so in your head, you can't, again, you can reassemble all of this and kind of see how the alt reality, alt life went once you've seen the entire story, but you don't know how to invest in that as a character.
I also
flaw.
Remember it being it's more super, charming. You know what I mean? No, I do. And I remember this being more charming than it actually is, which is, I think five, I want to say four or five, but maybe five separate times in the film, someone calls Marty McFly a chicken and he stops and the camera, you know, frames him up. And then a music cue goes dong and yep. he slowly turns around. It four or five times is a lot of times in a film for that to happen with no resolution to that beat.
And no setup. You're like, wait, what?
Yeah,
like when did he get, so offended about being called a chicken? and like, it's also, it's a chicken, by the way, because, yeah. because Biff goes on to elaborate. So the first person chronologically to call him a chicken is Biff. But by this time, we've already established that he hates being called chicken. And so Biff goes, what are you, chicken? You're just a little chicken. And then Marty McFly is like, nobody calls me chicken.
Yeah.
Where did this come from?
I don't know.
You know, it's from nowhere. And so that is his great character flaw.
Shakespearean flaw. He doesn't like to be called chicken. That is the source, as Lorraine tells us over and over and over again in 2015. Yeah, that's right. Guys, 2015 is when the future is set.
Yeah.
And she says over and over again, his whole life went wrong because people called him a chicken. And you're like, you told 17 different times in the future. It just hammers you on it. And it's crazy screenwriting.
Yeah. Yeah, and then it also teases all these little part three jokes
that you don't get
until you've seen part three.
Yeah. Old Biff's great grandfather, Wild Bill.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever his name is. Is it my turn or your turn?
I don't know.
I think it's my turn. Is that right?
Don't know.
Okay, I'm gonna pull one.
I don't remember pulling Back to the Future 2.
Do you want to pull? Well, no, because if you did Purple Rain. Which you did, and I must have done Back to the Future too.
All right.
This must
well.
Be. No, that's how
Thanks.
It works.
Thanks for
logic.
To cheat me.
Thanks. Well, hey, I'm the one who cheated you into it now.
You cheated me back, yeah.
Yeah, I cheated. I double right. cheated you. I Back to the Future your cheat.
Next week on Does Your Favorite Movie Suck, we will no longer be apologizing for
anything
poor or missed episodes. And we're going to be watching. Oh, man.
God, don't do this.
I'll do it. We'll watch it, I guess.
God damn it. off to a rousing start for next week. Yeah, good teaser, Kalen.
Oh, wait a minute. Can we do one more thing?
What?
Can we do one more thing?
Yeah, I guess.
We've only got 20 episodes, 22 episodes.
I'm still going to do more. I think we should do
roughly
more,
before, you know, and I would like them to be good episodes.
Okay.
This is the problem I've been having.
Can we weed out the bag?
That's what I'm asking.
I know.
Do you think it's time?
Yeah, not on air, but yes.
Well, do you want to do it right now? And then do you want to take a break? Do it right now a little bit and then come back.
Well, you've already pulled a movie, so
but
I feel like we're fucked a little bit.
Really dumb to watch.
Can I see it?
You can see it. Don't say it yet.
All right. I kind of want to watch that.
You do?
Well, for reasons that aren't interesting to listeners, though, so maybe.
You know what I mean?
There was a big display about this movie at the Museum of Popular Culture in Seattle.
So, about this movie?
Yeah, yeah. In the fantasy section, guys.
You understand this is the sequel.
I did not understand.
Yeah, so this is
sequel. I didn't look at the last word there.
Yeah.
Okay, no, I don't want
to
watch
it. I would love to watch the original.
Yeah, that's what I thought it was.
We're going to take a break.
Okay, we'll
be right back.
All right, guys, we're in the weed-out process of the bag.
Travis decided to turn the Kalen, mic back on.
Well, Kalen, we've got 15 or 20 here. Kalen has vetoed zero of them, and the one I vetoed is Hackers. Everything else is still in the bag. We haven't vetoed any
of them. You can hear it. Well, let's... How is this like...
No, we're fine.
48 hours.
Yeah, it stays in.
Yep. Trading Places.
Yeah, stays in.
Oh, that's fine.
Guys, we have it.
Great Mouse Detective.
Out.
Yeah. Sorry, fans of Great Mouse Detective. Mission Impossible.
In. Don't tell Mom the babysitter's dead. I say in.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, we'll be back, guys. We're not doing a good job.
Risky of Business.
In.
Bloodsport is in.
Obviously, Mortal Kombat also
stays.
We're almost
done. Nightmare Before Christmas, in.
Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey,
American
I'm keeping
History
it.
X?
I think we should.
Really?
Keep that. Yeah. Armageddon, we have to.
Our threshold turns out to be very high. for
well,
what we're
I actually
for.
Am impressed. We did manage to cut about, 30, 40?
Yeah, that's a good little stack there.
As I throw Happy Gilmore back in the bag.
I'm going to throw out Jewel of the Nile. We put in Romancing the Stone. We're throwing out Jewel of the Nile. They Live is going in. And finally, should this be the movie we watch? No. Police Academy 4
out.
Is out.
Out!
You hear that, folks?
All right, guys. We've culled the bag. It's not a major cull, but it's a minor cull.
So I'll now reveal the movie that started all of this was Conan the Destroyer.
So
now,
fuck
for
it.
Whoever really, really wants Conan the Destroyer.
I got confused. I thought it was Conan the Barbarian. I didn't finish the sentence.
We're getting serious here. We only have 22 episodes left.
And only 400 movies to pull from.
Yeah. So
what are we going to do?
But the new guarantee is that these are all selected movies that we have chosen and agreed to watch together. So the next film,
this is gonna
for
be
real,
embarrassing
that
though,
we're going to watch
yeah.
on Does Your Favorite Movie Suck is Labyrinth.
Okay. Well, you know what? We're knocking down the big guns right out the gate.
That's a big one. That's one for the fans.
This is probably one of the bigger ones. I will just want to say in way of teasing next week's episode that this last Halloween, my girlfriend and I went dressed as Jareth and Baby Toby from Labyrinth.
I don't know who those people are.
I will tweet a picture of it. See you next week.
Bye.